Good morning, listeners, and welcome back to Euromills podcast. In the past week, we already had talks with the Martin Center, with Dr. Nicholas Novacki, and member of European Parliament, Hilde Voetmans, on the strategic compass. Today, I'm very happy to have here with us Jamie Shee. Jamie was for 38 years a NATO servant. His last position was Deputy Assistant Secretary General. And for the moment, Jamie is Professor of Strategy and Security, but he is also the Secretary General of GMEC, the Global Military Advisory Council on Climate Change. And it's in this capacity that we would like to submit him some questions related to the strategic compass and climate. Good morning, Jamie.
Good morning, Emmanuel. Thank you for inviting me.
Happy to have you here once again at Euromill. Jamie, just to kick off very briefly, short question. What is for you the strategic compass in a few words?
I would say the European Union gets real, finally, about the nature of security threats in the wider world and shows a greater determination to do something concrete about them.
So what you see is finally there is something on the table, and now with the EU we can continue. And of course, yeah, that's what the strategic compass is about. Finally, let's say the European Union is growing up in security and defense. But let's jump into to our issue, what we wanted to talk with you on climate. The strategic compass, the document itself highlights the need for the EU to enhance its resilience to climate change, disasters and emergencies by adapting the security and defense sector, as well as EU CSDP missions and operations to climate change and in line with the EU's goals of climate neutrality by 2050 under the European Green Deal. Now, this is an ambitious plan. Do you think that the EU can accomplish this? And if yes, how?
Well, I certainly think that the European Union is picking up a lot of experience about handling disasters on its territory. You know, we've seen military forces deployed, Emmanuel, for counterterrorism, protection of buildings and infrastructure. We've seen our military forces deployed, obviously, to handle the COVID-19 vaccine, building hospitals, transporting sick patients from one hospital to another, also distributing and in some cases actually delivering vaccines. And of course, we've seen the military being mobilized to deal with forest fires, to deal with extreme flooding in my country, the UK, even to deliver petrol supplies to petrol stations over the last couple of months. So I think all of the experience that European military forces are acquiring now in dealing with these sort of non-conventional challenges, not war fighting, but resilience on the home front, is allowing them to acquire valuable experience about linking up with civilian authorities like civil emergency management ministries, home offices, the police, the fire brigade, etc. And so this networking, I think, is also going to be important when it comes to responding to climate change. But, and this is a big but, as we all know, the Ukraine conflict is going on at the moment. There's increasing pressure from NATO for Europe's military forces to go back to their more traditional role, defense and deterrence on borders, and to train for that mission. And so I think one challenge for the EU is what percentage of its military forces does it have going back to conventional territorial defense tasks, and which percentage does it keep for these more civilian or civ-mil resilience functions. And myself, I think the EU needs to set up a sort of EU equivalent of the NATO response force, but a civilian equivalent, a reserve equivalent of people with military training, but who would be more employed to deal with these domestic resilience, homeland defense scenarios. And of course, climate change manifestations would be part of that.
Yeah, I think we already talked about this at another event somewhere during a panel. And then I, as Euromill and me personally, we fully agree with you. It cannot be that military personnel is used every time again for different tasks and every morning waiting, okay, what is now on the agenda? What is happening? What is going on? And where can we contribute as military forces with our experience? At a certain moment, things have to be clear. We believe that this also has an impact on recruitment, retention of military personnel, and that we should see this in a more broader package than we do today. Climate change is also referred in the basket partnerships of the Strategic Compass. Cooperation with partners concerning climate change is deemed as essential, especially with NATO. What actions do you think can the EU and NATO take together to adapt defense sector to climate change?
Well, I think there are four things that they can do better together. Of course, as you know, Emmanuel, the cooperation has been going on for some time. And two joint declarations between NATO and the EU have been concluded already since 2014 and the Russian annexation of Crimea. But a third joint declaration is in the works. And I think this is an opportunity to give more prominence to climate change, particularly now that NATO finally, in the NATO 2030 project of the Secretary General and the context of the new NATO strategic concept, which is due to be concluded, as you know, in Madrid in June, has raised the profile of climate change in the alliance. And NATO has started to do some things, but like the EU forecasting partnerships, making its own military forces greener to show that it's serious. So I think this is a good time because a couple of years ago, NATO was doing almost nothing on climate change. So it could not really have been a viable partner for the EU, but it's different now. So what could they do? As I mentioned, four things. Number one, I think that we need to improve our forecasting and early warning mechanisms for where climate change is likely to produce tensions, conflicts over things perhaps like water or resources and population movements, in other words, to have a geopolitical destabilizing impact. Difficult to predict, but we can see earlier on now those stresses building up, and we need to track them. And the EU, of course, has got satellites like Copernicus, which are very good at monitoring temperature changes in the oceans, on land. NATO, of course, has got lots of satellite capability. NATO has a large intelligence gathering function, bigger than the EU. So in a complementary way, they can come together to compare analyses and come up with joint threat assessments. The Strategic Compass has the first EU common joint threat assessment. And I think, you know, putting those together in terms of ringing the alarm bell internationally on possible climate change destabilization would be useful. I think the second thing that they can work on is, of course, an exchange of experience in their armed forces. Think of the work, Emmanuel, of the European Defence Agency, the work that you're doing in EuroMIL, in looking at how military forces can be greener, use more green technology, more green vehicles, be less polluting, rely less on fossil fuels. A lot is going on. And I think an exchange of technology, an exchange of experience between the two organisations would be useful. The third thing is diplomacy. I've been looking at water recently, and it's clear that we are going to need a joint diplomacy to deal with issues like Ethiopia and the Great Renaissance Dam, potentially threatening the water supplies of Sudan and Egypt. Egypt has threatened repeatedly to go to war over that. We have tensions, of course, in the Middle East between Israel and its neighbors over the Lake of Galilee, over the sharing of the water of the Jordan River, tensions between Turkey and Iraq over the Tigris and Euphrates, and of course, between India and China, regarding the three great rivers in the Himalayas, which supply water up to 140 million Indians. And we need to look more at how diplomacy can come to agreements on fair, equitable water distribution. But also, as we've seen in the western part of the United States, with the sharing of the waters of the Colorado River Basin between a number of American and Mexican states, conservation and ecological preservation as well. Because, as you know, Emmanuel, if you don't regenerate the water and conserve the water, there's even less to argue about when it comes to sharing. So I think that diplomacy is going to be more important. And finally, of course, resilience in capacity building. The EU is now doing more than NATO in terms of training missions in Africa, and the wider world. NATO has gone back to focusing on collective defense, but both organizations have an aspiration to help other countries with capacity building, with resilience, and I think that know-how can be jointly shared with countries in Africa, so that armed forces are thinking also about how they can help civil society to build more resilience. So that knowledge sharing, I think, would be very valuable. And the European Peace Facility, which has now been established, it's been giving money to Ukraine to buy weapons recently, but it can also be a valuable source of finance also for these resilience projects to help very stressed countries in Africa and the Middle East cope better with the consequences of climate change.
Absolutely, Ellen. I would just like to add one short question to all that. Of course, we are quite satisfied having now the strategic compass. In June, as you correctly said, there will be the strategic concept of NATO. So these two things will go hand in hand, most probably, and let's hope. Our armed forces are much more than ever before coordinating what they are doing. But we always have this point on the European level that it seems that even with strategic compass, we don't really know in which way we are going. Are we going to a European Defense Union? Are we going to a much more closer collaboration between armed forces? Some of our colleagues are still dreaming of a European army, which honestly, I don't believe that this will be there in the decades to come. But shouldn't it be much clearer for the European Union what is the direction of its armed forces as such? Or do we continue to leave this in the hands of member states? And then very often we know the result.
Well, my sense, Emmanuel, particularly looking at the situation in Europe now with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is that we're going to have sort of two sets of forces in the future. One set will have pre-assigned missions. If Russia is now a threat to NATO, then units deployed in the Baltic states or Poland or the Black Sea, and many European countries have been sending additional forces, not just the Americans, but many EU countries to those locations recently. Those forces are likely to become permanent with permanent bases and with pre-assigned territories to defend. So this is your mission, the one mission, and train for that. Another set of forces are likely to be rotational. For example, like the NATO Response Force or the new EU 5,000 entry-level force that the strategic concept wishes to establish. They will be multitasked either to operate for collective defense in Europe or to operate for missions outside Europe. And I think getting the balance right between permanent, this is your mission, and the more flexible, no fixed assignment, rotational forces is going to be the key to success. Because obviously, even with Russia breathing down our necks, missions in Africa, humanitarian missions, UN peacekeeping, counter-terrorist operations, all of these things will go on. The French may have been withdrawing their land forces from Mali, but they and the EU will still be heavily implanted in the Sahel, at the very least, for many years to come. So I think this is going to be one of the key debates that we have to have. The next thing, and I say this as a Brit, is to be flexible regarding formats. The compass increases the level of ambition for the European Union and the EU institutions. I welcome that. But, you know, you're going to have still on the sidelines these regional groupings like the Northern Group, the Visegrad Four, the British-French cooperation under Lancaster House, President Macron's European Intervention Initiative. And frankly, for my country, the UK, after Brexit, which I regret, but it's a reality, cooperating with European defence is easier under the NATO banner or under the Northern Group or under President Macron's European Intervention Initiative, at least for the time being. So I think that on the behalf of the EU, a certain degree of flexibility at seeing, you know, which format brings in the greatest participation for which mission, sometimes EU, sometimes these more ad hoc regional groupings, is going to be the way to go. Because the key to this is not so much the format, but how do we get all of the right capabilities and the right players around the table to be successful at accomplishing this mission? And bringing in the non-EU powers, and Turkey, of course, is also going to be a challenge in this respect, I think to success.
Yeah, and well, as you know, in this whole collaboration of defense forces, that's where EuroMIL thinks that we have a role to play, because bringing our people much closer together, working together in the same circumstances with the same risks, the same mission, we strongly believe that at that point, we should also seek for having the same coverage, the same working conditions, but especially the same social protection for European military personnel. Jamie, let me come to the end of this podcast with one very short question, but perhaps not the easiest one to answer. What would for you be the outcome of the strategic compass at the point where you would say, now I'm satisfied as Jamie C with this as an outcome of the strategic compass?
Well, Emmanuel, first of all, on your previous point, I totally agree. We're going to be asking a lot more of our soldiers in the future, and we've been asking a lot of them over the last 10 years. And if we want them to protect us and even to fight for us, we have to treat them properly and treat them decently. That is the social contract for our armed forces. So I couldn't agree more. To answer your question, well, you know, my compatriot, Winston Churchill, liked to say that strategies are all very well, but one should occasionally look at the results. And so clearly, implementation. You and I know that documents, no matter how well written, and with a good level of ambition and a good coherence, are only worth the degree of implementation that they receive. Otherwise, they lose credibility quickly and gather dust on the shelves. And there are lots of documents produced by our international organizations in that category. So implementation delivery is going to be key, particularly when you look at how Washington will consider the entire exercise. What I would like to see is that by the end of the decade, the EU has a much more autonomous capability to successfully handle operations outside Europe, which the United States and NATO will not be willing or able to do. And secondly, that in NATO's collective defense in Europe, the EU is able to provide 50% of the capabilities that NATO needs, reducing the dependency on the United States, and that there'll be a rebalancing of defense budgets. NATO released its own figures last week in the Secretary General's annual report, showing that the United States still spends 70% of all of the NATO budgets and spends over twice per capita on defense as the highest European, which are in fact Norway, followed by the UK, non-EU countries. So a rebalancing within NATO and a greater autonomous EU capability to operate defending EU interests in the wider world. But again, the document is excellent, but it will be even more excellent if the EU actually implements it.
Thank you so much. And I think that at that point, we are not alone looking forward to the implementation and taking this as a serious point. I think that it was last week or the week before that High Representative Borrell also said that it will now depend on the implementation. Meanwhile, some of the EU defense ministers repeated this. So let's hope and let's cross fingers that we are now in reality going to a much better organized and structured European Defense Union, whatever there may be behind the wording European Defense Union. But one thing will be sure, it will be hand in hand with our NATO partners and with our friends from Canada and the US. Jamie, thank you very much for once again having been in or together with EuroMIL this time in a podcast. Hope to see you again in a panel or at another occasion on climate, on security and or defense. But once again, thanks for your always willingness to support us and being with us. Have a nice day.
Pleasure, Emmanuel, and thanks to you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.